This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are very worried that if the government were to succeed in this endeavor to have the ban on Twitter stay, then other social media platforms are at risk.
That was Emmanuel Ogbichi, chairman of the Nigeria Union of Journalists Abuja, on the Nigerian government's ban on Twitter. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopians are voting today. And G7 leaders pledge to donate 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses to poor countries. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopians vote today in what the government calls the country's first attempt at a free and fair election, while the northern Tigray region remains at war. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Addis Ababa.
By the time the sun rose, hundreds of people were already lined up at this polling station. Inside, election workers give instructions on how to vote, reminding people they can choose any party. An observer from the ruling Prosperity Party at one poll, Odinga Woolley, says she expects voter turnout to be higher than in any other election. Her words echo those of Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who said the election will be safe and the nation's first attempt at a free and fair election. At some polls, there is a celebratory mood, despite the long lines. But in a coffee shop over the weekend, some other Ethiopians say they will not be voting, calling the election fake. They are from the northern Tigray region and do not want to be recorded for security reasons. Tigray has been at war since last November, with federal government forces fighting the regional military. The election is not being held inside Tigray, and the vote is being postponed in several other locations. But some analysts say the outcome, which party wins a majority of seats in parliament and forms a government, will not necessarily be impacted. Here's Kia Teskei, an Ethiopian lawyer and political analyst.
The number of electoral regions that are not conducting election at this moment doesn't have that much significance.
What will be significant, he adds, is the number of people not represented in the new parliament because they couldn't vote. At the polls, some observers also report logistical problems, like polling stations without ballots for hours after they open, as well as violations, like candidates speaking to voters near the polls. Fitsumbifa is an observer for the main opposition party, Ethiopia Citizens for Social Justice.
There are some irregularities, and we are reporting to the election board.
Ethiopia's ruling Prosperity Party is widely expected to win this election, extending the rule of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for 5 years after he was appointed in 2018. Analysts say other parties are also expected to win seats in the national and local bodies of parliament. And voters at the polls are hopeful, with many saying they believe this election could be the beginning to an end of decades of one-party rule. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
As Ethiopians head to the polls today, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet issued a stark warning that rising poverty, inequality, injustice, and the erosion of democratic values were setting back human rights around the world. In her speech at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council's three-week session, Bachelet particularly noted the situation in Tigray.
In the Tigray region of Ethiopia, I'm deeply disturbed by continued reports of serious violation of international humanitarian law and gross human rights violations and abuses against civilians by all parties to the conflict, including extrajudicial executions, arbitrary arrests and detentions, sexual violence against children as well as adults, and forced displacement.
In many other parts of Ethiopia, Bachelet warned alarming incidents of deadly ethnic and intercommunal violence and displacement were increasing polarization to a more dangerous level. She urged dialogue throughout the country to address these grievances. With G7 leaders pledging to donate 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses to poor countries, the Kenyan government and the international community are under pressure to ramp up efforts to get jabs to millions of elderly people and other vulnerable groups. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
In Kibra, East Africa's largest informal settlement, older residents are waiting for their shots. Life in the slum, especially among the elderly, has been tough since the pandemic struck. Agnes Kariuki is the founder of Kibera Daycare Center for the Elderly.
The whole of COVID period, we have been together with these older persons. We have never closed down. As the government announced that 60 years and above, they are at risk of getting the disease. And because they were told to stay at home, it was our work to see if, even if they are at home, they should eat and they should dress and they should do any other activity that they are supposed to do.
For many years, the 63-year-old caregiver has been looking after the elderly residents of Kibra, one of the biggest slums in Africa. But when COVID-19 struck, she was frustrated.
It was our work to move from door to door to see the older persons are really helped during this COVID time. We are glad the children who are working, they are jobless, and the house is really suffering. It's a very difficult time because a number of other people who have been also affected, they are also looking for well-wishers, the same as we are doing, so we collide in the field.
The pandemic, she says, has dealt a severe blow to older persons in the slums, where families live in congested houses with no running water, no toilets, and lack of other social amenities. Such conditions put the elderly at a greater risk of severe cases of COVID-19. Adam Ahmed is among a few lucky elderly persons in Kibra who have received the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine.
I've been vaccinated. It was on 14th May, and you were supposed to go for the second one. I've not felt anything unusual. I see in the news here that people who feel a little bit sick and so on, but then with me, things are quite okay. Quite a number have not received this vaccine yet because it seems to get so quickly out of stock.
Kenya has vaccinated less than 1% of its nearly 50 million population. Another million people got their first dose, but they do not know when they will get the second. With the vaccine in very short supply, health authorities say efforts are underway to procure more. At the Center for the Elderly, caregivers like Agnes are worried. Dr. Kanyenje Gakombe is a Kenyan medic who has been at the forefront of the battle against COVID-19. He wants more people vaccinated, saying Kenya is bracing for a fourth wave of the pandemic.
The best vaccine is the one that is available to be administered to those who need it now. Because as we wait, there are those who are still getting sick and dying. If we are able to administer everyone who requires a second dose now, they will be that much safer.
Last week, the G7 nations committed to donate 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses to low and middle-income countries. President Joe Biden also announced that the U.S. would donate 500 million Pfizer doses through the COVAX initiative to the African Union and to additional low and middle-income countries, the largest ever donation of vaccine by any country. The U.S. has announced more than $91 million U.S. dollars in urgently needed food assistance, health care, water, and psychosocial support across Africa due to urgent COVID-related needs. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Hospitals in several South African provinces are full as the most serious outbreak of COVID-19 yet sweeps the country. The government provided emergency beds at facilities, but they cannot be used because nurses and doctors are in very short supply. In the midst of the coronavirus third wave, some of South Africa's top medical scientists disagree about how best to manage what so far has been a slow vaccination drive. Darren Taylor reports.
Less than 500,000 South Africans have been fully vaccinated, with another 1.7 million partially protected, as they've yet to receive a booster injection. The government says 40 million need jabs for herd immunity against COVID-19. Medical scientists say the third wave is so much more deadly because it's targeting a population that's mostly unvaccinated. Some medical minds say certain aspects of the state's vaccination strategy, such as the decision to inoculate teachers ahead of other, more vulnerable groups, aren't logical.
Even if we vaccinated every single teacher tomorrow, we will not protect them from the third wave.
Professor Francois Venter is an infectious diseases expert at Wits University in Johannesburg.
We haven't even vaccinated 20% of our old people yet, not a single person under 60 with a comorbidity, and yet we're suddenly throwing vaccines at other groups in this piecemeal fashion. Why stop at the teachers? Why not vaccinate the parents, the taxi drivers and the bus drivers taking the children to school? It's just not a coherent response.
The government says teachers are some of the first in line for jabs because the future of the country depends on getting its education system back on track as fast as possible. Another of the country's leading medical scientists, Professor Shabir Mahdi, is also criticizing the state's vaccination plan.
Not to have used the AstraZeneca vaccine and then blindly to actually decide to actually pursue the Sinovac vaccine, where we got absolutely no evidence how it will work against the Beta variant. Again, I'm not too clear what the thinking is and what the logic is and who actually advises government on these sort of matters.
One of those government advisors is Professor Barry Shoup, an internationally renowned virologist. He says Mahdi's got his facts wrong.
The government is not pursuing Sinovac. We, as a ministerial advisory committee, have got an open mind to all vaccines. We're examining all vaccines, including AstraZeneca. We haven't dismissed AstraZeneca. We suspended AstraZeneca in the beginning because it's just a supposition that it may work against severe infection. And there's no data to actually prove that. In fact, there's some laboratory data which suggests that it may well not prevent severe infection.
So far, almost 2 million in South Africa have been infected, with almost 60,000 deaths. The country worst affected by the pandemic on the continent obviously needs as many people to be vaccinated as fast as possible. Yet some vaccination sites are deserted, with jabs sitting in fridges unused. Again, Venter blames poor planning by government.
You can't simply sit back and say, there's a service, come hither. And unfortunately, that has been the Department of Health's response. And government, unfortunately, has spent a lot of time not communicating where these sites are. A lot of government officials are saying, well, we've provided the service. It's on you now to take it up. When only 20% of the people have taken it up, the problem is your fault. This is not vaccine hesitancy. This is bad program application.
The health department says it's easy for experts such as Venter and Mahdi to sit on the sidelines and criticize, but it and its advisors don't have the luxury of time to nitpick, and their focus remains on making the best possible decisions to keep people alive. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The suspension of Twitter in Africa's most populous country has left Nigerians coping with the ban and fearing the government could ban other social media platforms. From Abuja, Nigeria, reporter Munachi Chuks takes a look at the situation.
Nigeria's government announced it was suspending Twitter indefinitely after a tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari was deleted for violating the company's abusive behavior policy. Users of this platform who use it to connect with people, share knowledge, and run their businesses have cried out about the economic impact the ban would have on them. The chairman of the Nigeria Union of Journalists, Abuja, Emmanuel Obeche, expressed worries that such government regulation efforts could spread.
I think they are testing the ground for wide-range efforts to curtail the right freedom of expression, for the media to hold them accountable and to be transparent. And we are very worried that if the government were to succeed in this endeavor to have the ban on Twitter stay, then other social media platforms are at risk.
Obuechi noted that the implications of the ban are very grave and should be redressed. Yemi Itodo, chairman of National Assembly New Media Forum, a forum of online journalists, lamented that the ban already has destroyed businesses.
On Twitter, we have about 12 million subscribers, an average of 5 to 6 million viewers every day. But since the ban, we are practically shut out of the market. As I speak to you, nothing is moving for us, and all my members in National Assembly keep on complaining.
According to a report, about 50% of Nigeria's population used the internet as of January. Any efforts by the government to regulate social media platforms will discourage many from connecting to the internet. A human rights lawyer in Abuja, Frank Tete, says the ban is a total disregard of the fundamental rights of the people.
The Nigerian human rights community is indeed shocked that nearly 40 million Nigerians will be deprived access to use Twitter simply because the Nigerian president is offended that one of his tweets has been removed by Twitter. Imagine that the right to access information and to use social media tools to enhance business and social relations will be stopped totally.
Tete said the government's action portends a very bad development for business and indeed all social economic activities. An online activist and social media businesswoman, Cecilia James, urged the government to focus more on fighting insurgency than Twitter.
It's unfortunate. Our government only thinks about politics, winning election and all of that, and nothing else matters. Our youth are largely unemployed, insecurity is ravaging everybody, and it is Twitter that is their problem of all the problems in this country.
The government confirmed that Twitter has formally written to seek for dialogue on the suspension of these operations in the country. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks. From Abuja.
The U.S. Embassy in Libya confirmed its views, the reopening of the coastal road between Sète and Misrata, as extremely irrelevant as the international community is preparing for the Berlin II conference. However, the head, Khalifa Haftar's forces delegation at the 5+5 Joint Military Commission, JMC, Karia Al-Tamani says, news about reopening the road is not true, saying the GMC decides such matters.
Prime Minister Dabeiba, during the last days and weeks, massively urged for the opening of the coastal road. He wants to present this as a symbol of progress at the upcoming Berlin conference on Wednesday. I've heard, let's say a rumor, that Dabeiba has promised to pay outstanding salaries and bonuses to the Misrata militias to convince them to allow the opening of the road. And last Sunday, after months of delay, the last earth barrier on the Libyan army operational canal site was removed about 85 kilometers west of Sirte in the presence of Prime Minister Dabeiba. And as you said, the LNA immediately stated that the coastal road would only be opened on their side on the orders of the JMC. Well, this meeting started today in the morning. On the side of the operational volcano, Major General Ibrahim Bayt Al-Mal, the commander of the Sirte sector, has demanded that the Russian mercenaries must withdraw now within 15 days. And he has also demanded that the LNA needs to withdraw from Sirte district immediately. I would say today a joint decision by the 5+5 Joint Military Commission to open the coastal road seems very probable, as the LNA doesn't want to be branded in Berlin as a spoiler of the Berlin process, especially as they had repeatedly stated before that they are ready to open the road. But Al-Mal's ultimatum suggests that the road may soon be closed again, as a Russian withdrawal without a simultaneous Turkish withdrawal is highly unlikely, let alone a withdrawal of the Libyan National Army.
The Libyan Presidential Council, as the supreme commander of the army, issued a statement prohibiting any repositioning of military units for any purpose, regardless of the nature of their work or the transfer of personnel, weapons, or ammunition without its prior approval. The PC's decision follows the movement of Haftar's forces toward the southern eastern border crossing with Algeria, declaring the area as a military zone in which movement was strictly forbidden. How would you explain that?
In the last weeks, Presidential Council Deputy Abdullah Al-Lafi, he is from Savia in Tripolitania, signed several documents and decrees with the letterhead Presidential Council, Supreme Command of the Libyan Army. This included also prohibiting the military parade in Benghazi and various appointments of commanders in the south. But Al-Lafi is not authorized to sign such documents on behalf of the Supreme Commander. The Supreme Commander is the chairman of the PC, Al-Menfi, and not Al-Lafi. So I would consider these decrees as some kind of psychological warfare and an attempt to split specific southern tribes from the LNA, which could well work. It is noteworthy and a sign of weakness that Al-Lafi has for the time being not yet been called to order by Al-Menfi, at least not in public. Southern Libya, especially Fezzan, is a safe haven for numerous terrorist groups. And we know that the LNA has a very wide definition of terrorist groups, but this includes also Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and ISIS, as well as Sudanese and Chadian and Nigerian rebel groups. Libya has its significant share in the rapidly increasing destabilization of southern Sahara states like Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad. So it could well be that the LNA was urged by some Western states to do some more about this problem, especially as the GNU has no influence in this region whatsoever. And furthermore, in the last weeks, there were at least six security-related incidents in Fezzan involving Akim and ISIS, and not the those who are considered as also as terrorists by the LNA. And in these clashes, the LNA lost several killed. So this could also have contributed to the LNA decision to launch the current offensive, which will certainly also be again a very heavy-handed one.
That was Wolfgang Pashtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi. Botswanan President Mokgweetsi Masisi says proceeds from the sale of the world's third largest diamond will be used to advance national development in the southern African country. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Two miners found the 1,098-carat diamond early this month in the collection bin at Debswana's Drowning Mine, a joint venture between the government and the world's leading diamond miner, De Beers, 120 kilometers west of the capital, Habaroni. On Wednesday, the precious stone was presented to Masisi, who offered assurances that proceeds from its sale will benefit the nation.
And you can rest assured that our national development needs will in part be met by the proceeds from this diamond. And we will distribute the resources through the distribution system that we have, and therefore develop this country.
The stone's value isn't yet established, but a 1,109-carat diamond, also mined in Botswana, fetched $53 million in 2017. Debswana acting managing director Lynette Armstrong says the yet-to-be-named diamond will be evaluated soon.
Of course, the stone has not been valued. It is a rare find. It still has to go through the full process of valuation. So today I cannot tell you what it is worth. This stone, as we put our facts together, is believed to be the third largest gem quality find in the world.
The 3,106 Cullinan diamond mined in South Africa in 1905 remains the largest, followed by Lesedi Larona, which was unearthed in Botswana in 2015. Botswana's Minister of Mineral Resources, Lefoko Moahi, says the recent find is timely, coming at a time when diamond revenues are falling.
It is indeed an occasion to celebrate. An occasion to celebrate for Botswana, especially during this time where we need every little tebe we can get so that we can push our development agenda as well as boost our economy.
Botswana is Africa's leading diamond producer, but due to COVID-19, revenue from the gems have declined as travel restrictions closed out international buyers, limiting sales. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.